Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
So, people, hello. Welcome to Movie Crush. Here with Dan Bush on another film series. And I guess your film series is just whatever Dan wants to talk about. We don't have to have a theme. But we were speaking before we had technical difficulties about the fact that the world's going to hell in a handbasket and what you're doing about it. And I think it's good advice.
Mm-hmm. How to quit worrying and learn to.
Yeah, exactly. Way to tie that in.
I was just, the idea of like think globally, act locally. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, if you internalize that and act really, really specifically locally and start with your own freaking mind.
What's the most local?
What's the most local?
It's your brain.
And then work outward from there of like, okay, being sort of mindful and thoughtful. And I don't mean to be on a soapbox, but I just myself, I was like, why don't I take a minute and get away from the chatter and all of the Trump tweets and all of the stuff going on with the impeachment hearings and everything about, not that all that stuff doesn't need to be addressed, not that it's not extremely important, but
but
to hold space for yourself just for a second.
Self-care,
and take a minute and take a deep breath and go. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, you go, okay, actually, when I walk out my door and look around, there's not that much conflict.
Yeah.
It's, you know, people are, for the most part, and I think this is probably true, it's just that the filter of the media puts everything in such a, it packs everything into this sort of, you know, laser.
Yeah.
It shoots right into your brain.
And then social media on top of it.
Right. And
it's and, even
and,
worse.
And we're addicted to that. And we have like, you know, so just the idea of like, can I actually put my phone down, put it away while I'm sleeping?
Right.
Take a deep breath. Take 10 minutes for myself every day. Just 10 minutes to just sit there and do nothing.
And
more than that, like try to really hang out with my kids when they're around as
right.
opposed to like, yes. I'm trying to do this thing while you're, no, it's like.
That's my biggest trap, man. It just makes me feel like a garbage parent. Is when I'm distracted and she's trying to get my attention.
Yeah. So, and I've been doing things with them like, you know, your kids can do shit. Mm-hmm. My kids only, there's three-year-old and one's almost five. And it's like, they can do stuff. So like, I don't have to be like, you sit there while I cook. I'm like, come over here. This is a burner on the stove. Be careful.
Yeah,
it's hot. And
exactly.
Here's a knife you can cut, but here I'm going to show you how. And
right.
I know that sounds like a dangerous thing for a parent to do. But
no,
I'm like,
man.
Make them, you know, get them. They love being involved. So it takes you long. So, you know, I'm not unloading the dishwasher. I'm being with my kid, and that's the activity.
Yes.
As opposed to, God damn it, I got to get this done.
Yeah, that's so valuable. And it's really easy to fall into that trap of busy distraction stuff. But, like, you're modeling, man. You're teaching them. Mm-hmm. And that's going to come back and bite us all in the ass when they're teenagers and they don't have the attention for us, you know, because they were raised with a parent staring at a phone.
Right.
It's no good. It fucking sucks. I want to, like, smash my phone on a daily basis.
But, you know, but then there's something about, and I'm not, you know, a survivalist by any stretch, but I'm like, I want to imbue them with some skills.
Sure.
The world's going to be pretty nasty if we, on the current track.
It would not hurt to know how to start a fire without a match.
Enjoy these times before it's,
How do you know, start little things like that.
Yeah. How do you grow something?
Right. Exactly.
I don't know. I'm not good at it, but we can learn together. Come on, kids.
Yeah. Terra farming. Let's do it.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. And what we were talking about before, it's like it's really easy to go down that rabbit hole of everything is shitty right now. But if you walk outside your door and you look around your home and your community and your neighborhood, hopefully that makes you feel good. It does in my case.
Without sounding cheesy, all you really have is now.
Mm-hmm.
Everything before this doesn't exist.
Nope.
Everything that's about to happen doesn't exist.
Nope.
So there's, you know, you have all the potential in the world.
Yeah, man.
Right here.
I feel like we should take LSD right now and see what happens.
Yeah, let's do it.
We should do that on a episode. How fun and weird would that be?
Yeah, I met with a friend of mine the other day that I'm working with, and he's like, by the way, I'm microdosing today. I'm like, oh, okay. That sounds awesome. How do you do that? And he's like, oh, well, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh. It's a thing.
It sounds,
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do that. I have a friend who microdoses marijuana edibles for migraines.
Oh, okay.
And she doesn't ever, I don't think, feel, she never feels stoned or anything.
Okay.
And it's like through a doctor. And it's just like tiny little bits of edibles right. all throughout the day.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And apparently it helps out the migraines.
Is that like the CBD or is that just...
No, I mean, it's the real deal, THC.
Okay.
But
it's just a tiny bit of THC, which is the only psychoactive property of the only psychoactive...
Right.
It's
the only good stuff.
Cannabinoid or
cannabinoid?
Cannabinoid.
I think that's it.
Anyway.
Well, Dr. Strangelove.
Let's get high and watch Dr. Strangelove.
What do you think this is? Wednesday night? Mm. No, it's Thursday morning. I watched this Wednesday night. And for the many, manyth time, mm-hmm. I've seen this movie a lot.
Have you?
Yeah, but it was like it had been a while.
Were you excited to talk about
Super excited.
That's cool.
To watch it again and talk about it.
Yeah.
So let's do it. I have a couple of bits of fun trivia.
Yeah, I've got a bunch.
I'll sprinkle them out. You probably know this stuff, but for the benefit of the listener, he had a few different titles, apparently. Dr. Doomsday or How to Start World War III Without Even Trying would have been good. Dr. Strangelove's Secret Uses of Uranus.
I heard that one.
And then Wonderful Bomb, which mm-hmm. that's pretty good.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Wonderful Bomb.
Yeah, I like that one. Did you have any other ones? Any titles?
No, I didn't have any. I didn't jot down the titles that I'd heard of, but...
What other trivia you got?
Oh, man, just tons of shit. All right, let me look here. So Sellers was going to play four characters.
I think I saw that. He was going to play Slim Pickens' part, right?
He was going to do Slim Pickens' part, and there's a bunch of different, you know, theories about why that didn't
work. Yeah, I saw one story where he faked a broken leg so he wouldn't have to, right. But that sounds made up.
Yeah, so we wouldn't have to because I'm like, it's Peter Sellers. He's probably going to nail a Texas accent if he needs to.
Well, but I heard that the accent was one of the problems and that Kubrick right. didn't like it.
Right.
It's hard to tell.
But yeah, and then another one, Pickens, Slim Pickens, who did play that pilot, was also in the running to play the Scatman Crothers part in The Shining.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not sure why.
Well, I love
the racial tones in The Shining.
Yeah.
The racist overtones in The Shining, probably.
Totally. I mean, I loved Scatman Crothers in that movie.
Yeah.
But I could totally see Slim Pickens playing that part.
Well, they both are these not character actors, but actors who are characters. They're
yeah.
these guys who are authentically themselves.
Totally.
So.
And apparently Slim Pickens is 100% that guy.
Really?
Yeah, like, and they're like, he wasn't a method actor.
Right.
That's just him.
What else I got? Reagan, after he was inaugurated, wanted to see the war room.
Oh, really?
And there was no war room. But that's the first, he's like,
he was an actor.
He wanted to see the war room.
He didn't know that?
Let me see.
I've got one for you.
Okay.
The war room, Kubrick insisted that the war room table be covered in green baize, which is like felt. So even though it wouldn't read on black and white, so they all felt like they were just a bunch of men playing poker with the like a big poker table.
That's awesome.
Like, that's essentially what you're doing is playing poker with the world.
Right.
And nuclear war, as Slim Pickens calls it. Slim Pickens.
So he covered it in green felt.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good, even though it's a black and white movie.
Oh, yeah, here's a huge one. So the line was changed from Dallas to Vegas. The line when Slim Pickens like, oh, I could have a pretty good time. He's opening up the survival kit.
That's one of my favorite parts when he's reading all that
yeah,
stuff out.
Yeah, and he says, you know, at the end, he's like, yeah. He's like, nylon stockings,
yeah.
one prophylactic. You could have a pretty good time in Vegas.
Yeah, yeah.
That line is dubbed later.
It looked funny.
It was not. It was ADR.
Oh, okay.
Because the original line was Dallas. You could have a pretty good time in Dallas with this stuff. And they changed it. Do you know why?
Oh, wait a minute. Kennedy?
The original release date was November 22nd, 1963.
Wow.
The day Kennedy got shot.
Wow.
So they pulled the movie.
Uh-huh.
And they changed a few things. And then the movie came out, you know, January of 64.
Wow. So they held it that long, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that they held it for like 3 months or 4 months or whatever. But I always think about that. And I'm like, okay, if you have Kennedy assassination, which is like the first and most significant sort of point where you go, the world and our nation goes, oh, okay, there's more at work, there's mm-hmm. more sleight of hand, there's more stuff happening behind the scenes than we're aware of
right.
for this to be possible. And if this man represents the best of us, regardless of whatever he, you know, if he was or wasn't on all the arguments about Kennedy, but he represented this knight in shining armor.
Right.
And then he gets taken down. And then a couple of months later, Strangelove comes out, which is all about the industrial complex,
right.
military complex, and how full of shit it all is.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think you have the makings in those two first moments for the launch of the counterculture.
Yeah,
I feel like those two things are like okay.
Because what year was this?
63.
Yeah, I mean,
those are the first two things that make everybody go, okay, our government is not. They aren't all to be trusted.
Yeah.
And there's more than, you know, at hand than meets the eye. And then Vietnam.
Yeah.
I just feel like those are the beginnings of that, you know, that huge revolution.
Totally.
It's a cultural revolution that happened.
Yeah. One thing this movie really, what jumped out at me last night more than ever before was how ahead of its time it felt.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's black and white, it has this weird contemporary feel to it, starting from the very beginning with those opening credits in it. And I think I tracked it down to just the font
mm-hmm.
and the credit sequence, mm. which was, you know, very unusual for the time. You know, that it looks, you know, hand-drawn in pencil.
You know who did that?
Who?
Pablo Ferro.
Who's that?
He's a guy. He's a graphic designer. He also did the Stop Making Sense album.
Oh, of course. There you have it. Looks just like it.
Right.
I never tie those together.
Yeah.
Yeah, but and maybe that helps explain it because it definitely didn't look like a title sequence from 1964.
No, it looks like something out of, you know, 1990s or 2000s or whatever.
Yeah, it felt very contemporary. And and that, you know, the opening is so great with the planes fucking each other basically. There's so much sexual innuendo throughout this whole movie.
Yeah, to that whatever that sort of. Not elevator music, but it's...
Yeah,
it's,
whatever it was.
I can't remember what
it was. Fantastic.
Was. Yeah.
And just so, like, Kubrick, you know?
Yeah, the whole thing is sexual, is power and sex. The whole damn movie, it's sex, power, you know?
Yeah, and I think he didn't get enough...
Strange Love.
Yeah.
Power and sex.
Which he named himself Strange Love, right? We find that out.
Does he? I don't know that.
Yeah, it's later on in the movie. He said, George C. Scott's like, what kind of a name is Strange Love? And he says, well, he gave himself that name.
When he
became a citizen or whatever.
Right.
And he says what it was before. I can't remember what it was. Man, how great is George C. Scott in this movie?
It's incredible. And you never see him does he ever do any other comedy?
I don't think so, man. And I read, I don't know if this is true, I guess it is, that Kubrick had him go super broad.
Uh-huh.
And he said, like, we're not going to use this stuff. It's just sort of a test to see how far you can go with it or whatever.
Right.
And that's the stuff that he used.
I heard because Kubrick has got that. He's notoriously did like 100 takes or whatever,
yeah.
And to the point where the actors were so pissed off and freaked out.
That, uh-huh.
So the version I heard was kind of like same thing he did with Nicholson in The Shining, where he got him so pissed that he was like, "Is that what you want? You want me to like I, you know, you want me to just not be subtle at all? Okay, like this?
Yeah."
And he was like, "Yeah,
you want
like,
crazy?
Yeah, like this. You want crazy? Yeah, like, I'll show you crazy." And he's rolling his eyes and he's going bug nuts. And
yeah.
It's just amazing.
Oh, man. I mean, George C. Scott is so good in this. And everybody, I mean, it's an acting tour de force. Sterling Hayden
mm-hmm.
is just off the charts. And this is a movie with Peter Sellers, like peak Peter Sellers.
Right.
You know?
And Peter Sellers gets to play the straight guy opposite of Sterling Hayden.
Yeah.
And then he gets to play the straight guy opposite of Turgeson, which is...
Uh-huh.
George E. Scott.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way.
And then he gets to play Strangelove.
And then he gets to play Strangelove.
He gets to have some fun. who was your favorite of the three?
Of Sellers' characters?
Yeah, yeah.
Strangelove.
Really?
Yeah, I think just because it's...
Oh, no, I mean, it's
I mean,
great.
It's hard to... I mean, they're all fantastic.
No, they're all amazing. And I always... Just Strangelove is so easy because it's so funny.
Uh-huh.
But I think President Muffley, like, it's that phone call, man.
Merkin Muffley.
That fucking phone call just seals the deal for me. that first phone call, or both the phone calls, but that first phone call to Dimitri.
Right.
I'm just as capable of being sad. Oh, man. So good. Right. And I actually printed out that whole thing.
Oh, you did?
It's a lot of fun. It wasn't sad. I'm capable of being just as sorry as you, Dimitri.
Yeah. I know you're sorry, but I'm sorry too, Dimitri.
Well, then it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
And right before that, he's like, well, you know, that thing, something like the,
yeah.
The thing we always, do you have it there? About the bomb.
Uh-huh.
We got to talk about the bomb. It's like he's talking to an ex-wife about the kid got arrested or.
It's really funny. He said, one of our base commanders, he had sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head, you know, and. He went and did a silly thing.
Yeah, started World War III.
Oh, man. I so love it.
I like to talk about structure a lot.
But
this one is like I'm trying to pin it down. And I was looking around. I was like, what other movies like? How does this structurally work at all? And other than being like a political farce or whatever, there's not too many of those. But I can't think of anything that's like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think that of anything before it or after it that is like it. It's like a lot of things, but – it's its own category.
Yeah, it's very compartmentalized structurally. Like he only has those – he's got the plane set and that storyline. He's got the war room.
Right.
And he's got the office basically.
Right. And the initial scene with Turgeson and the
– Yeah, you got the great
– and the secretary.
Oh, man.
Which is – it's all like – they're already living in bunkers.
Yeah.
They're already living in like these – there's no outside view of the world at all except from that plane.
Yeah.
I think. Oh, and then when they cut to the documentary footage of them attacking the base.
Is that
long lenses and very tight and it's – so there's no – it's hard to
– So did he shoot that or was that
– I don't know.
Okay. I couldn't quite tell.
It looks like it's suddenly cutting from these shots that are locked off.
Yeah.
Medium wides of everybody,
uh-huh.
and then occasionally like a specific close-up of like Sterling Hayden is his name from down below.
Yeah, those great Dutch.
So you're like, oh, he looks insane from this angle. But other than that, it's like these medium wide shots that just play out through the whole thing like a stage play, and then they cut to this handheld documentary footage.
It's really jarring.
Yeah,
and intense, like shades of Full Metal Jacket to come.
Right.
But it's very jarring when it goes to those battle scenes.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing about the movie is it's like, okay, if you think – I once heard a – I guess it was a lecture that – who was giving that lecture? The writer, Breakfast of Champions.
Oh, Kurt
Vonnegut.
Vonnegut? Yeah.
Sorry. Vonnegut was giving this lecture at the college that I was in, at USC in South Carolina, and he came and gave this lecture about structure, and he was talking about there's – in tragedy, there's like – you know, you starts off with there's going to be a war or some horrible event, you know, some pestilence or whatever, and then the one guy who might be able to save everybody fails to do so because of his own hubris or his pride or whatever, and then everybody dies. And that's like tragic structure, so it's like this you know, inverted U.
Right.
And then – the other comedy structure that Aristotle talked about in Poetics and that Vonnegut was kind of reiterating here was he was like, okay, in the other structure, everything starts off, there's going to be a wedding or a birth with comedy. And then some asshole decides to ruin everything and, you know, trash the day.
Yeah.
And together, everybody bonds together. The people who maybe had their differences all come together in the end. And they save the day. And the comedy ends with like a birth or a wedding.
Right.
You know, you can think about everything from like The Hangover to
sure.
you know, all the comedies that have ever been made. They always end with a birth or a wedding.
Right.
and everybody comes together to figure it out. But this one, this is not a comic structure.
No.
It's not a tragic structure. It's this weird amalgam of the two where like the only way for everybody to come together in the end of the movie and win is to lose.
Yeah.
The only way you can win is by losing.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like a tragicomedy or it's like some sort of
– it is a strange movie tonally. I mean, it's obviously a satire and clearly a comedy.
And you know about the pie fight?
Yeah.
Let's
talk about
it
though, because that was they shot it and everything.
Right.
The original ending was they in the war room they break out into a pie fight.
Right.
Which
and they use thousands of pies per day to capture this thing. And
has a lot of merit. I saw a picture. Have you ever seen any of them?
No.
I have one right here.
It says a Mythical Lost. I'm like that's article. kind of a perfect ending. I guess he pulled back from that, but it's kind of a beautiful ending to a you know what is kind of a body humor farce movie.
There's like a shot, a still shot at least of what that looked like. Yeah, I mean, how do you end this movie? It's a tough one to.
But that's a comedic ending.
Yeah,
I mean, that's a comedy ending. You know,
it could have ended with Slim Pickens riding that bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of, that kind of feels like the ending.
Right.
But then there's
then they come back to the monologue about...
Well, that great bit about repopulating the world.
Yeah. 10 women to one man.
Yeah, and he's basically saying like, well, we're going to have to get a bunch of sexy, sexed up women.
Right.
Because they have certain proclivities.
Right.
Like we want to make
they're
going
to have to be appealing for you know...
Right, exactly. And you see George, you see Turgidson over there just like, you know, licking his lips because he's such a, you know, such a dog. And the real ending is great, you know.
Yeah.
He stands, Mein Führer, I can walk. And then that's
cut
it.
Cut to the bombs. Explode.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
God. But a pie fight has merit. Like I could have seen that
mm-hmm.
sort of ridiculous Three Stooges-y ending to this thing.
Well, that's the thing is this weird, like every, you know, this movie's not absurd because they're dealing with the real world's absurd.
Yeah.
They're just, and it's just loaded with this body humor. The first time we see, like the first time that he gets the code mm-hmm. or gets the orders for Plan R, the guy on the
in the plane?
Yeah, like the communications officer on the plane gets the Plan R and mm-hmm. he's like, okay. And he's just like stuffing his face and he's chewing on, there's food.
Yeah.
Like, he's like trying to swallow while he's saying, hey, anyway. And then, you know, it cuts to the sort of bunker-like space. It's like a hotel room that Turgidson and his secretary are in. And she's like doing some tanning.
She's in a bikini.
She's in a bikini and
she's
gorgeous. He's taking a shit.
Yeah. And she's relaying this, like basically relaying, not basically, right. She is fully relaying a phone call
right.
about we're about to start an accidental nuclear war while he's taking a dump in
right.
the other room.
With all the politeness in the world.
That and scene then, is fantastic. She's really great in that.
Brilliant. And then there's, he's constantly, Turgidson is just constantly chewing gum.
Yeah.
It's just all this body. I'm surprised the movie, honestly, the pie fight makes sense because I'm surprised the movie didn't have like fart jokes. I'm surprised that people weren't like.
Yeah, because it veers into that territory comedically.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this is Kubrick's, he didn't do anything else approaching comedy, did he?
I mean, you know, I've heard that on the set of The Shining, they were laughing their asses off.
Well, okay. But as far as movies go.
No.
Like this is.
Tonally, this
I'm trying to get into his head of like, what did Stanley Kubrick find funny?
Right.
Because he's not a funny filmmaker and doesn't come across as a funny guy.
Right, yeah.
And this is the only thing we have to go on.
That's true.
You know?
And there's weird things that I just laughed at. Like when Slim Pickens is first like, are you sure it's Plan R? Are you sure? And he's like, all right, I'm coming back there. And like this whole scene has been him talking to somebody in the back of the plane.
Yeah.
And there's all this distance between them. And he says, I'm coming back there. And he turns around and they're like 5 feet away.
Right.
like, that's humorous. And I don't know.
That was pretty funny.
You know, that's kind of subtle, I don't know, timing or something. That
yeah. So shout out to Tracy Reed, who is the woman who played Miss Scott. We've already gone over Scott and Sellers, Slim Pickens, Sterling Hayden, a young James Earl Jones on the plane. Huge shout out to Keenan Wynn, who plays Colonel Bat Guano, the guy that comes in at the end and basically holds Mandrake, you know, hostage for a brief time. He does such a good job.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
And it just ends with like the machine peeing in his face.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like pure slapstick. But this collection of nameless, faceless men in the war room.
Mm-hmm.
Last night I was really fixated during the Strangelove stuff on seeing if I could catch any of them in the background cracking up.
Right.
And like how the fuck were they able to just stay so stoic?
I think
in the midst of that
genius. It's take 100.
Yeah. Although I don't know if he did that with Sellers because I read that Sellers said that he did this to Kubrick did this to break down the actor's sense of self. And he said, I have never had a sense of self, so you don't need to do that with me.
I heard he was the only one that Kubrick ever let improvise.
Yeah, I saw that too. Kubrick said he's the only actor that can really do it.
Right.
Which, man, it's a high compliment.
Yeah, and it makes me – seeing this again, I want to go back and watch Being There again.
Oh, man. One of my favorites.
Yeah.
So good. I got
Hal Ashby.
My entree into Being There was Mad Magazine's parody of Being There.
Oh, really?
That I read when I was a kid because I was a Mad Magazine obsessive. And, you know, they had all these, adult-type themed movies in Mad mm-hmm. Magazine that, like, 10-year-old Chuck is reading about all these movies that, like, I have no idea what they are. You know, they did stuff like Raiders of the Lost Ark every now and then, but
right.
a lot of times it was this sort of high-minded stuff they were kind of poking fun
yeah,
at.
Yeah, it's adult.
And it's all being there later on, and, you know, it's just so great. There's a bunch of his movies. I've never seen Lolita.
Right, I've never seen Lolita
yeah.
either.
It's like, so. It's got, he plays several roles in that one too, right?
And I heard that that was potentially going to be a comedy at some point. But I
think
know how
it teeters on that edge, if yeah. I'm not mistaken. I got to check it out, though. There's yeah. a lot of Peter Sellers out there I need to see. I was a Pink Panther nut.
Oh, okay.
As a kid.
Right.
I thought that was just nothing funnier in the world
right.
to me than Inspector Clouseau.
But, you know, I think about Kubrick's, like, a lot of his, the way he shot stuff with those, you know, those center-punched frames that are wide and last way too long.
Yeah.
Just, you're just watching it, and it's so perfectly balanced. There's something about the way the composition is that he always does mm-hmm. in Clockwork Orange and in other – that is intrinsically funny to me. Like, I can't – you know, everybody thinks, oh, it's disturbed, or it's maybe it's so center-punched that it's almost disturbing because it's, like, so – calculated and specific.
And you think the tongue is in cheek?
I do. I think there's something.
I get that.
Something where he's going, look at this, how stupid this is, or how
right.
absurd this is.
Yeah.
And something about the framing makes me go, makes me giddy, kind of tickles my tummy. And I'm like, this is ridiculous. Like,
yeah.
You know, and you, like the scenes in Full Metal Jacket when he's, you know, when they're marching around and
yeah.
he's like, this is my, you know, I don't.
This is my rifle. This
is my gun. Yeah. And it just holds on it for too long, and it stays center punched, and it
yeah.
never does anything else. And it's just after a while, I'm going to start laughing.
Yeah, boy, I miss Cooper.
And I think he's doing. I think it's intentional. I don't know.
I think you're right. I don't think he's like, well, this is a pretty frame or whatever.
Right.
Like
he's not being serious.
No, I don't think so. I think you're right. You know? There is little bits of humor throughout his stuff when you kind of look at it. Through that lens.
I heard somebody describing Strangelove as like it's Mel Brooks, but
yeah,
but conducted by this like brilliant chess playing,
yeah,
you know, chess master, you know, hyper intelligent filmmaker. But it's Mel Brooks
yeah.
humor or something.
Totally.
That's an interesting.
Yeah. And, I mean, you were talking a second ago about the serious stuff in this movie, like all of the stuff on the plane, all of the conversations, the political conversations, it's all like, it is not, I mean, it's satire, but it's not, it's all perfectly squared away and as it would be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like he wrote it funny.
Right.
Like, he writes it. I mean, there's funny stuff going on around it, but it's all very real.
Right.
I mean, George C. Scott has that folder on his desk. Where is it? World Targets and Megadeaths. That's the folder.
Is that what it says?
Yes. That's on the title on the spine. And that was a whole thing mm-hmm. of a fairly new idea of talking about megadeaths, like numbering mm-hmm. deaths and megadeaths because of nuclear war
right.
was a new thing. And that's one of the folders he's like squeezing at his chest once the ambassador gets there. You know, that pinko commie ambassador, he's got to guard all his stuff. So he's literally hugging the World Targets and Megadeths folder.
Right.
You know, to keep it safe.
Right. Like a, yeah.
But that's
like a schoolboy.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a real thing. It's not, you imagine that's exactly what it was like.
Let me think. I'm looking at all this other stuff. The quotes in the movie are just out of control. I mean, it's just the most beautiful irony I've ever heard in a movie.
Well, gentlemen, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat, toe-to-toe with the Ruskies. And that's that Johnny Comes Marching Home cue right there,
right.
too.
And they always come back to it when they come back to the guys.
Yeah, it's just really effective.
It's the only time they use music, I think, except maybe at the beginning and the end.
Yeah, that's it. There's that elevator music at the beginning, and the very end they have that song. And then Johnny Comes Marching Home, that refrain over and over and over. So good.
Well, here's what he's like. There's Muffley's talking to Turgeson. He's like, there's nothing to figure out, General Turgeson. The man is obviously a psychotic. He's like, well, you know, let's hold off on judgment on a thing like that until all the facts are in.
Right.
He's like, Turgeson. He's like, when you initiated the human reliability tests, you assumed that there was no possibility of such a thing ever happening. He's like, well, I don't know if it's quite fair to condemn the whole program because of one little slip up.
Well, and that's Turgenson's thing. The whole time, it's not dawning on him that this is like possibly the end of the world, you know, or that, you know, 20 million people, like that's acceptable.
Right.
And I guess in the grand scheme of things, you know, he may be right. That's better than 150 million people. It's better than total annihilation.
Yeah, I got that one too. He says, we are rapidly approaching a moment of truth for both ourselves as human beings and for the life of our nation. Now, truth is not always a pleasant thing, but it's necessary to make a choice and to choose between two admittedly regrettable but nevertheless distinguishable post-war environments, one where 20 million people get killed and the other one where you have 150 million people killed. And he's like, you're talking about mass murder, not war. And he's like,
yeah.
I'm not saying we're not going to get our hair a little mussed.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite parts. George C. Scott really shines in this movie. It like really hit me last night. But is toward the end when they're talking about when the plane has been hit and they're flying super low under the radar. And he's asking about their chances, basically. And George C. Scott gets all excited. And he kind of forgets himself that he's talking about, like, oh, yeah, they're going to drop the bomb. He's like, oh, yeah, you should see. They can get down there real low. And he puts his arms out like planes' wings. And then he realizes what he's talking about, you know, and he kind of collects himself again.
You should see it—a big plane like that getting all low. He can something about roasting the chickens in the chicken house or something.
Yeah,
all this.
And before that, he has
flamboyant Americanisms and patriotic.
Well, he's excited, you know. Like,
And he loves war. He loves power.
That's exactly it. He's excited. I mean, he's the one that leaps.
And he's
the
envious,
opportunity to do this.
He's envious of the bomb. I was like, oh, man, I wish we had one of those doomsday devices.
Yeah.
And then he's envious of Ripper.
Uh-huh.
He's like, Ripper had the guts to, like, do this thing.
That's right.
He's kind of, like, secretly is, like, praising.
Well, and he's talking about when they're—
He's so excited.
When the base is invading, you know, it's a civil war breaking out, basically. And he's talking about, like, oh, you're going to have a real hard time with my guys. And the other guy's like, with all due respect, like, we should be able to brush them aside with ease or whatever. And you can tell it's like a big dick contest all of a sudden.
All this infighting. And then you have – and then this other really weird thing is, like, you have what's the president's name?
Muffley.
Uh-huh. Merkin Muffley.
Yeah.
Who's this effeminate –
these ridiculous names, Kissoff, Muffley, Bat Guano.
And he's and Muffley is supposed to be like the one voice of reason other than the commander who's in there with Ripper.
Right.
Other than the
Mandrake.
Mandrake, the British guy. But so he's the point of reason and he's and it's just the opposite of what we have today. Today the military is more cautious.
Yeah.
And the president is, you know, obviously the president.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, he's completely fucking insane.
He has a great line.
But isn't it inverted from when this movie was made? I mean, Eisenhower was the one who was like, who first implemented the idea of like having an officer be able to in the event that the president is wiped out.
Right.
We're going to make it so that certain elite officers can follow through with a nuclear strike.
Yeah, like a plan C or whatever.
Yeah. And he was hesitant to do so, but then they made it a thing. And so that's what the whole movie's sort of based on is like these planes are always flying within 2 hours of their any target or whatever. And that's why they have to fuel in the air, you know, and all this stuff. But it's all based on those early decisions.
Yeah.
They're, I think, still intact.
Well, and he says that. He's like, you know, you're the one that signed off on this.
Right.
And the disbelief, which is very reasonable, like, are you telling me, like, there's literally no way to back out of this at this point? Like, there's no fail-safe for us?
Right.
And that's when George C. Scott, that's when Turgenson says, well, we could look at this as an opportunity.
Right.
Like, if it's going to happen anyway, we can catch them with their pants down and just wipe them out.
Right, which is what – and that's what Ripper wanted. He's like
– That's right.
This is the way this goes down. And it gets into this thing of paradoxes that I think Kubrick had mentioned. Like, there's no way to follow through – on the game theory of this or the military strategy or the chess game. There's no way – it's that war games thing of like there's no way that any outcome – so there's the irony or the – you can look at it mathematically and go, okay, in a nuclear strike, if you strike first, you can knock out 90% of their mm-hmm. of their artillery, and then they'll strike with what they have left, 10%. With their 10%, they can knock out 90% of ours.
Right.
So at the end, we have 10% left, and they have nothing. So we win.
Right.
Meanwhile, the world is no longer inhabitable. Yeah. And that's – it's always like this – yeah. That, so there's that one paradox of like the 90% theory.
And that's before they learn of the doomsday device, of course.
Right.
Which wipes out everybody.
Yeah, which is just a fear mechanism.
Yeah.
The other one was the always-never dilemma. Let me read this. It says, the command and control of nuclear weapons has long been plagued by an always-never dilemma. The administrative and technological systems that are necessary to ensure that nuclear weapons are always available to use in wartime might be quite different from the ones those necessary to guarantee that such weapons can never be used without proper authorization in peacetime. And those two things are in perfect conflict with each other, and there's no way to reconcile them.
Yeah.
So
there it is right there.
And the weirdest thing of all is that the president, you know, even if these other people have to go through certain procedures and they have to be two keys and there's two different parts of a code that's sent to unlock the two keys so that they can both check each other before doing a nuclear strike. There's all these things at hand if you're like – if Washington's been wiped out.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is that the president is the only person that has zero checks.
Right.
Because there's all the ICBMs take 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
That's not enough time to get Congress to vote.
Right.
So there has to be the ability of the president to launch an all-out nuclear strike at all times.
Right.
And I don't know what that policy looks like now. I heard they were trying to change it because of our current president.
Oh, really?
I heard that that the Pentagon, they're actually scared.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't have anything to verify that. But,
right. Well, it makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
One of my favorite parts is early on when and I love all the Mandrake Ripper stuff. It's just so great. And like Ripper has clearly lost his mind.
Right.
Because from the beginning he's talking about the conspiracy, which was in the 50s. It was a real thing that people were worried about was the fluoridation.
Right.
And that it was the Russians and, you know, they were brainwashing us, basically poisoning us.
The communist conspiracy to.
Exactly. But Ripper has bought into this, and Mandrake, God, he's so good. Sellers is so good in that role. There's that one scene where Ripper calmly gets up and walks over and locks the door, and puts the key in his pocket, and Mandrake doesn't even notice, like, because they're just talking. And then Mandrake has his moment. Mm-hmm. He stands at attention, and he's basically like, you know, I have to tell you right now that, you know, as an officer, I can't go through with this or whatever, how he says it. And I'm gonna leave and go stop this. And he goes over. And
the door's locked. Yeah.
And then he checks the other door, and that's locked.
Right.
And he knows.
And the look
he's
on
fucked.
The look on Mandrake's face, Sellers' face, when he's like, "Oh no, it's to my thinking, that's really not quite the right way to look at it, or whatever." And he's like, "Because of this and that," and then it dawns on him. He's like, "Right." So it's my duty at this point in time to let you know that because I'm, you know, I'm servicing the Queen, the Queen's army or whatever.
Right, right.
All this procedural bullshit.
It was interesting that they made him an RAF officer. And I think the first few times I saw this, I didn't fully understand that was a real thing.
Right.
My brother-in-law is in the Marines, and they do that.
Exchange program?
Yeah. Some of his best buddies over the years were these Royal Marines. And they love that shit, man, to find, you know, a like-minded dude with a cool accent, you know, that they can bond with, because they're the same over there, man.
Right.
You know, that mentality is the same.
Huh.
And he loved his Royal Marine pals whenever they trained together and stuff.
That's cool.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
But I wonder why he did that, though, in this.
Why have the second command
why had
be
him
this?
Be British? I mean, it could have been an American XO.
Yeah. I think maybe because something about him being an outsider and being outside of the normal ranks.
Yeah.
Maybe made us, it would presuppose that this guy might be able to think differently or he might be honoring his ultimate loyalty is to something different.
Yeah.
So that gives him at least some plausibility to be able to like even stand up to this guy he doesn't kinda, really, but he.
Well, they sort of test each other, you know, like that scene later before Ripper kills himself in the bathroom.
Yeah.
He's asking about, you know, were you ever a prisoner of war?
Right.
Were you ever tortured? And Peter Sellers, he's so nervous at that point. He's like, yes, you know, I was. The Japanese tortured me, and it's not a pleasant story.
Right. He's like, but, I figure they're going to have a pretty good time with me when they get up here.
Yeah.
and they're probably going to be able to. It's like, without a doubt, they're going to be able to extract the code from you. So you might as well give it to me.
Yeah, he really uses it tries to use it to his advantage. Uh-huh. And then he goes in the bathroom. Oh, that's right. Just clean yourself up or whatever. Right.
Perfect. I think that's a wonderful.
And then the door is blocked by the body. It's so funny and morbid. It's really great.
Yeah.
And all those sets are just amazing. I mean, there's only a few sets, but they're just perfect. That War Room set is one of the most iconic movie sets in history, I think.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's vast, but yet at the same time, it feels like you're underneath a volcano.
Just, yeah, it's gorgeous. It's so clean, and they use darkness so to their advantage.
Right.
Because they just cloak it all in blackness, basically.
It just
falls
off into nothing.
Except for that great ring light.
Yeah.
Which apparently was most of the lighting.
It's almost like the War Room exists in this ambiguous, like, nebulous space.
Yeah.
That we don't know where it is or how, you know.
It's so cool.
It's like a Matrix or something.
When you see pictures of it, because it doesn't, it reads differently when you see a photograph of the set.
Oh, okay.
Like, as they were using it. It's fucking great. It's gorgeous. And the set, you know, it was the 60s, so it's not like he made it look like the times, but
right.
Those great, the big computer rooms and then Ripper's office, it was just like so like beautifully 60s.
And then the low angles in the War Room, you could always shoot up and get, George C. Scott always has the big board behind him. There's always there, you know. Uh-huh.
You'll see the big board. Yeah. There's so many classic lines. There's no fighting in the
War
Room.
There's another huge piece of delicious irony. Almost every time you see the men fighting, whether that – I don't know if that footage was stuff they shot for the movie or not, but
– I think he shot it, yeah.
Okay. It seems like he would have to.
It looks like stock documentary footage, but
– But he shot it to make it feel like war
Yeah,
footage.
Because they use the outside of Shepperton Studios.
Right.
Apparently is the set.
But everywhere and almost every background, there's a sign that says peace is our profession while the tanks are going off on each other.
Yeah. I mean, that's so like obvious and on the nose. But
the whole movie's just so on the nose.
Yeah.
It's so over the top and it's specific.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people, I don't know how you can miss that. A lot of people seem to think, you know, what? I guess the satire falls off on some people. But I'm like, this is the most specifically clear.
Yeah, like he's banging you over the head with it.
Yeah, it's not like George C. Scott is actually playing a guy who's thoughtful.
Right.
He's playing he's just an archetype. He's just a caricature.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I don't know how you could read
anything else into it, but.
Of course, the grain, alcohol, and rainwater.
Yeah.
That became such an iconic sort of thing. I've heard that line uttered in many a bar.
Have you?
Oh,
yeah,
sure.
That makes sense.
Yeah, people that, you know, think they're being clever.
I've got the Mandrake. It's like, Mandrake, do you recall what so-and-so said about war? And he's like, war is too important to be left for the generals. When he said that 50 years ago, he may have been right. But today, it's too important to be left to the politicians. They neither have the time, the training, nor the inclination for strategic thought. And I can no longer sit back and allow the communist infiltration and communist indoctrination and communist subversion of the international communist conspiracy to sap and purify all of our precious bodily fluids. And then the whole movie is about bodily fluids.
I know.
The whole movie is about male power.
Yeah.
Being sapped.
And fluoridation kicks it all off.
I just love how no matter what, even like whether it's she calls him in the War Room and she's like, but you know,
yeah,
but don't you want to spend time with me or whatever? And he's like, oh, I love you, baby.
Yeah.
I'm going to make you Mrs. Turgeson.
You start the countdown.
Yeah.
And I'll be back here
before you say blast off.
Little Bucky will be back before you blast off.
And then, and she's, yeah, I mean, everything about it is just body humor and sex. And,
yeah.
And then the president's call with Dimitri, who's a drunk.
Uh-huh.
On the other end of the line,
yeah,
and it's like
I think he's been drinking.
Yeah, it's like they're ex lovers or something is the way that the relationship works, right? I mean,
yeah. Why do you think I'm calling you just to say hello? Of course, I like to speak to you. Of course, I like to say hello. Not now, but anytime, Dimitri. I mean, when you see this chunk of dialogue like
I'm just
that,
as sorry as you are, Dimitri.
Oh, my God. He just acts the shit out of that part.
And I guess it's all improv or a lot of it.
Well, I mean, I don't know, man. I'd be curious.
Yeah.
Because that's such a large chunk.
Yeah, the camera doesn't cut. It just sits on
it doesn't cut at all. And George C. Scott, too. He has these, I mean, he just acts the shit out of it. There are these just long, crazy monologues where he's not – and not – I mean, he's physically acting too. That right. scene where he falls over was real.
Right.
Apparently.
And he was mad that they kept it in the movie or whatever.
Oh, was he?
I guess.
Oh, interesting.
But, and you can tell that they cut pretty quick after he stands back up because he's – as he's standing up, he's still delivering lines.
No, I mean, it's beautiful. It's one of the great moments in the movie because you're left to wonder like – was that real?
Yeah.
Or did that just happen? Was that written in?
What is, I mean, this, like, I don't, again, I don't know if there's ever been a movie like this or ever will be again. I mean, it just seems like there's Wag the Dog and then there's Veep and there's these, like, attempts at
political
satire.
Which are great. Death of Stalin. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
Uh-huh.
It's just fucking great.
Right.
And in fact, that movie tonally comes closer to this than anything I've seen, I think.
Does it?
Death of Stalin? I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a different film, but it feels like a little bit of the DNA of this film is in that movie.
Yeah. And I guess that brings me to the idea of like what – there's so much that could not have come after without this movie. Like this movie is responsible. I even think about like – it's almost like a mockumentary in a way.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
I mean, when they cut out the war footage and they have like – I guess that the beginning is like a slate that they had to roll from the U.S. Air Force that they had to put in the movie. I think that first.
Oh, really?
The first like role that says something.
Oh, about, that it's not based on anyone real or whatever.
Something like that. Yeah. But even I mean everything about it. There's and then they have this objective narrator, you know, this omniscient narrator who's like like a wartime, you know,
like a newsreel
uh-huh. who's giving you this stuff and that happens. I think twice in the movie, and then they cut to this newsreel footage, like war footage of the attack on the base.
Yeah,
and other than that, right? It's all staged, but. It just, it's got this feel to me like a mockumentary quality to it. It's supposed to feel like a newsreel at times.
And yeah.
I don't know if Spinal Tap would have happened without Strangelove.
No, I'm with you.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. The Onion may not have happened without Strangelove.
Yeah.
You know?
I honestly think it's just so ahead of its time.
I'm curious about the birth of satire. I don't know much about it, like what the first satire was.
Well, for I guess you can even look at like Shakespeare. There's always a clown who's mocking a king.
Right.
You know, there's evidence of political satire that goes pretty far back.
Yeah,
I think.
Guess so.
But I don't know if it's ever handled like, you know, the end of the world or if ever it's been so black and so, you know, nihilistic.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And how else can you treat this stuff? I guess they wanted to. Apparently, they spent years trying to make this into a real.
Oh, really?
They were. It was only. It was late in the game. They decided, in like many iterations of the script, they kept laughing, and they were like, "Okay, well, we're laughing. This is really a comedy."
So before it was a straight.
They wanted to make a thriller,
end of the world thriller.
Yeah.
Wow, boy. They
and then
the
Failsafe
right
came out a few years later, I guess.
Yeah, I saw there was like a lawsuit or something.
Yeah,
Kubrick tried to sue.
And that's Sidney Lumet, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm so struck at how the genius of going, oh, there's no other way to handle this.
Yeah.
You can't take this stuff seriously.
And we'll end it with a pie fight.
Yeah. We'll end it with a fucking magnificent, glorious pie fight that's on par with like total annihilation of the war.
I love how I love how quickly the story gets going. I mean, it's like it's fired out of a cannon with Ripper early on setting the stakes, having lost his mind and like this is what's happening. And there's no like – you're right. It's not like any other movie. There's no kind of classic character development as you think of it in films. It's just – but the characters are all super developed somehow.
Yeah.
It's like this weird little magic trick in a movie that's an hour and 45 minutes long that just – it's going so fast.
It's this portrait of total and complete absurdity.
Yeah.
And it's just goddamn gorgeous.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've just never seen anything quite like it.
Well, and gorgeous, you know, we can't – I know we talked about the set some, but we haven't really touched on the black and white and just what a beautiful movie it is.
Yeah. It's low-key. It feels – I heard somebody talking about how at the time there was – color movies were for comedies and black and whites were still reserved for like – you know, noirs and...
Oh, so we kind of flipped it?
So we kind of flipped that too, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if audiences going in had any, you know, they didn't... I don't know if they knew what they were going into.
Yeah.
I don't know if they... I don't know how they would have responded. I mean, was it promoted as a comedy or was it... I don't know.
I don't know, man. in 1964? What did the American public think of this?
Right.
It was fairly
maybe that's
successful.
The subversive thing about it. Maybe he was like hoping they would go in thinking,
right,
oh, this is a real thriller. Like this is an actual thing.
Yeah.
And they get this other thing that they were not expecting and maybe don't even know how to react to because there's not necessarily, you know.
There was no comp.
Right. Yeah, so that's subversive as hell. That's punk rock as hell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean.
Get everybody in the theater and then feed them this. Yeah. And then there was all these people, the backlash from the military saying, this is completely inaccurate. This is, you know, it's borderline dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that it wasn't inaccurate.
Oh, no, I read that a lot of, like, even the pilots and all were like, no, this was scarily accurate. So much so that Kubrick was afraid that the guy who helped him out with that stuff had gotten illegal information.
Right. Kubrick always seems to be a time traveler to me. He seems to always have his hand on some – either he's got a magical imagination
mm-hmm.
or he's actually, you know, in some conspiracy, you know, like got a straight line into like all of the classified information.
Yeah.
You know, in the Illuminati or something.
Right.
You know, there's all these conspiracy – because he does it again and again and again. Yeah, and he always seems to have – be way, way out in front, way ahead of whatever – so there's something magical about his genius that nobody can put their finger on.
He's the best ever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He really is.
In his own way, yeah, yeah.
Because, like, I'm trying – I mean, we did a series and we didn't abandon it. We just kind of paused it with my buddy Casey here, on Kubrick, and we covered Eyes Wide Shut and Barry Lyndon and Full Metal Jacket and The Shining, I think, was all. And that's – or did we do – Ramsey, did we do – now I can't think of it. The Droogies.
Oh, yeah. Clockwork Orange.
Did we do Clockwork Orange?
No, someone else did Clockwork Orange.
Oh, that's right. That was AJ.
Did you guys do Paths of Glory?
Paths of Glory, yeah.
We did Paths of Glory. That's right. And then we
The
bailed.
Killing.
Well, we didn't do The Killing. We didn't do
Which
2001.
Is also, what's his name? Hayden.
Oh, is he in that? Sterling Hayden?
Yeah, he's the lead.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I've only seen The Killing once.
Yeah, me too.
And that was like in college.
Yeah.
But Kubrick was always just so in his own lane. Like,
mm-hmm.
they're more than movies. I'm not trying to like to elevate him to this like godlike
no,
status.
No, I mean,
but
they weren't
movies. They were different.
They were different. And there's like I was just in London, and there was the Kubrick exhibit at the Design Museum.
I missed that in L.A.
I went over there, and I tried to I didn't look it up before. I just went over there because we had a film in the festival, and I went over there and tried to get in. It was sold out, unfortunately, so I didn't get to go in and look at it. I almost snuck in. I was like,
I was about to say, there's got to be a way to get
in. I almost
there.
Snuck in. I got halfway in, and my wife was lingering behind, and I was like, I either need to just abandon her and go in here and see this. And when I came back, I was like, God, I could have gotten in. She's like, you should have gone in, man. I would have figured it out.
Right.
I was like, yeah, but I'm.
She's like, I would have just gone and had tea or something.
Yeah.
What were you doing in London?
We were there because our film, The Dark Red, was screening, had its European premiere.
Oh, nice.
At Fright Fest.
How'd that go?
London. It was fantastic, man.
Really?
We had a killer. Yeah, a bunch of our crew came.
Awesome.
Elizabeth Davidovich came, and April Billingsley, the lead, came. Uh-huh. And Davidovich is our stunt coordinator, and she's amazing. And Ben Lovett was there, our composer, mm-hmm. and Victoria Warren was there, and Victoria's our DP.
That's great.
Yeah, and we all came, and like the movie was really well received, and it was just the best we could have ever hoped for. Because
how fun!
Fright Fest is like one of the top four genre fests.
Yeah,
and just to have it so well received, and we were scared because the movie's not total horror; it's not
right
for a genre festival. This one's a little bit more of a thought piece, and it was maybe they needed a break from the crazy blood splatter, but it was very well received, and we're excited.
That's awesome, dude!
And it's coming out in March, so.
And in London, like, how fun was that?
Yeah.
One of my favorite cities in the world.
It's like the coolest city ever.
Yeah.
I had forgotten how just fantastic.
I fucking love it, man. I would move to London in a second.
Right. Or it was Berlin forever. Now it's London again.
I've never been to Berlin.
Berlin's great.
I know. I missed my chance.
Well, I had a question for you. When you were a kid, because you're my age, so to what degree before the Cold War sort of collapsed around the wall coming down, to what degree did you grow up like me, terrified that there was going to be a nuclear war? I mean, that was the shadow that we lived in growing
yeah.
up, right?
It was very real. I remember, as I'm sure you do, the day after
right.
that TV movie with Jason Robards.
Yeah.
And my dad, after that movie, we started building a bomb shelter in our basement.
Seriously?
Yes. We started digging out. It was behind our this wood shop, behind the cinder block walls of the wood shop was, you know, red clay.
Right.
And he knocked a hole in that wall, and we started digging.
No
And he
kidding.
Had me and my brother digging. And
you physically built a bomb?
Well, no, we didn't. True to form, he stopped after a few weeks. And we had, you know, after my brother and I dug out, you know, 150 wheelbarrows full of red clay.
What was that impact on you? Like when you're like, okay, we're taking, for one, what was the impact of like, okay, we're building a bunker.
Yeah.
And like, we're in this because the world's going to end.
Part of you think that's kind of cool.
And two, what was the impact of like, oh, we're not doing this anymore because right. that was just a movie and nobody really cares.
Well, I was a little kid. So part of it is kind of cool because I think there's something about War Games and growing up with that film.
Right.
And Red Dawn growing mm-hmm. up with that film.
Right.
There was a little bit of like, yeah, man, like I'm going to be in the woods with a rifle and a football.
Yeah.
Or and a bunch of cans of soup and we'll be okay. Like I still have that zombie apocalypse sort of weird fantasy like, I'd be all right.
We did too. I lived in the Plaza Midwood area in Charlotte, North Carolina, and there was this section of woods behind like the golf course that mm-hmm. was over there. And there was this weird division between where we were, the like sort of middle class, lower middle class, and then like this weird pocket of like upper middle class mm-hmm. and mansions and shit. And the dividing line were these woods. And we would play Vietnam War.
Yeah.
We would go in there. I think I'd seen Apocalypse Now uh-huh. or something. And we would go in there and we would ambush each other. And it was the most delightful. These war games we'd play in the woods were the most delightful thing in the world. I didn't know anything about the true terror and
sure.
horror of Vietnam.
No, we did the same thing, man.
But
we shot bottle rockets at each other.
Yeah. Roman candle wars.
Those are the best.
Yeah.
But to answer your second part of that question, when we stopped building it, I was just relieved to not have to be digging anymore on the weekends. There was no sense of like, but are we going to be okay? Like, why aren't we doing this thing that seemed very important?
Right.
But yeah, you know, I was watching Red Dawn and Night of the Comet and all these sort of disaster scenario movies.
Right.
But it was just it, like you said, it was the way it was.
A friend of mine my parents did not, we didn't go to church growing up.
Uh-huh.
We quit very early on. My dad was a chemist, and he had had an experience at some church in South Carolina where he had like basically abandoned. He at one point they showed signs of being very racist at this one church that he was that he was actually doing Sunday or like Bible school in.
Yeah.
For adults, and he basically said, I'm never going to darken your doors again.
Yeah.
I'm done with this. And then there was this snowball effect with him. He eventually backed away from the entire thing. And he basically raised us almost as atheists, mm-hmm. Or at least agnostics. And anything that has any dogma at all, he's terrified of. He's like, anybody who thinks that they know the right way to do anything, then walk away as quick as possible and not run or stop them. And
smart man.
But there's this one friend of mine who took me to like this youth Christian church camp. And my dad was like, okay, I guess you can go see what the other side is like.
Right.
And I went and I met all the crazies there. There are all these kids that were like part of this youth Christian camp thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the one guy who I kept it hush-hush at that point because I'd learned by going to camp in South Carolina that the more I speak about this, the less the more I'm hated and people fear me.
You're like, they don't know that I'm not one of them.
I would play the Beatles and talk about, you know, how much I don't go to church. And then they would, and how we don't know if God exists. And they would like, you know, I was outcast. So I was like, okay, I'll shut up about that. But I met all these kids who were like obsessed. They sent me after I left camp. They're like, we decided you're cool enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me this letter in the mail with like this debriefing about what to do in case of a nuclear war. And they had this survivalist club that they had started.
Wow.
I'm talking 9 years old, 10 years old.
Yeah. That's scary shit.
Yeah. And I was like, you guys have started your own club on how to survive a nuclear war.
Uh-huh.
And you're inviting me to join your posse.
Right.
And I was just like, it was insane.
Yeah.
But that's the kind of shit that would happen to us when we were growing up in the shadow of nuclear war.
We did it for fun.
This weird thing happened. Yeah, sure. This weird thing happened where it all, and I remember I was at a very open school, and I joined this extracurricular class in the sixth grade called the World Peace Club.
Nice.
We would talk about ways that we could manufacture.
Achieve world peace.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's
but adorable. I just was terrified growing up. I was like, okay, this is how we're going out.
Yeah.
And it affected it this Gen X sensibility in me of like, nothing matters.
Uh-huh. Well, I think all
Why
of
not
us.
Litter? Why yeah. not? Why not smoke?
Right.
Why not do drugs? Who gives a shit? You know? Right? I think and then at some point it all went away. At some point it was like, okay, so that's gone. Whew.
Yeah.
We dodged a bullet there, didn't we?
Yeah.
But it hasn't. There's still these broken arrows, which is broken arrows, the term for
sure.
a lost nuke.
Uh-huh.
There's broken arrows that happen all the time. And I brought you this. This is a printout of all the broken arrows.
Really?
Well, it's the 35.
What are you doing to me, Dan?
It's the 35 declassified broken arrows that,
really?
That they were speaking about. And one of them is in off of Tybee Island.
Well, I know about that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one that it's underwater somewhere, right?
Another one's in Aiken, South Carolina. Yeah, it's lost forever.
There's one in Aiken?
There's one in Aiken.
Wow.
There was a broken arrow happened in Aiken. There's one in Florence, South Carolina.
Why are they all in South Carolina?
Well, no, there's hundreds.
Okay.
These are just happen to be the ones around
us.
So
this is going to be my toilet reading for the next few days.
Yeah. I figured you guys had talked about that on.
No, you know, we've never done one. That's stuff. A great idea, Broken Arrow.
Yeah.
Stuff you should know. It's not just a Travolta movie. Wasn't that Travolta?
Was it?
Is that John
I don't know.
Woo?
I don't know.
Or am I thinking Face Off?
Face Off.
Ramsey's nodding.
Anyway.
Back to the movie.
Sorry, yeah.
No, it all ties in, you know.
I think the movie for me, because of that, because of growing up in the shadow of this weird, absurd condition that
yeah.
we all might blow ourselves up at any minute. The movie was this like release of pressure for me.
When did you see it first?
I think I saw it in college, so I didn't see it in high school.
I definitely didn't see it in high school. I was thinking college.
I must have seen it around like 1990 or something and 92. Anyway,
yeah.
So right when we were going in the first like Gulf War, right around then is when I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was already kind of an anti-war kid at the time. And then—
Did you sit around and watch the war on TV in college like we
yeah.
did?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the pizza, and we'd go to the pizza place and watch the war.
Yep. It was weird.
But in the way that people were reacting and the way that like the frat boys in this
yeah.
school that I was in were like so— immediately gung-ho about it. I was like, and then I think I watched the movie
uh-huh.
Strangelove, and it just was like this release, like, okay, so I'm not crazy. So I'm not the only one who gets that this is all bullshit and all
right.
these people are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And this is just completely insane.
Mm-hmm.
This is lunacy.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so there's been subversive messages from way back.
Yeah.
There's the relief of knowing that I wasn't the only one that
right.
felt this way.
Yeah.
And that there is actually a long history of it was wonderful.
Yeah, so, I mean
that's why the movie is kind of a crush for me.
Well, it's a movie too that changes over the years for as you age, because my first viewings of this is a lot of it was lost on me, and a lot of it was the broad performances that I thought were funny, and of course Dr. Strangelove and his alien hand syndrome,
mm-hmm.
which I have no idea why they did that. I think my favorite thing about all of that is the fact that no one ever acknowledges it.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the great, I mean, there's funny stuff throughout.
He starts choking himself, you mean? And
yeah, but the end when he's, it's the sequence of hand steering
uh-huh.
the wheelchair in a little
semicircle. He's like trying to go away. He's like, nah.
And then to the chin punch,
uh-huh.
to the hand bite,
to
the choke. That fucking sequence. I was dying. And when it came out, she's like, what are you laughing at? I was like, I can see that part 1,000 times and it will still make me laugh out loud.
While all of this is happening while he's talking about
yeah.
how to survive in a cave.
I wonder if you thought of that stuff. Is that Sellers? I mean, that's not in the script. Like, he has alien hand syndrome and no one notices.
Well, I think.
It had to
I don't know
Sellers.
Where they came up with the Dr. Strangelove character, because he wasn't in the book that they
right.
were mostly basing it on.
Yeah. Apparently, the president, it had to have been Sellers, because for Muffly, he originally was going to play him as being really, really sick with a cold.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that he was so good at it
right.
with all the cold stuff that he, no one could keep a straight face. And they're like,
right.
and Kubrick was like, you gotta lose it, man. I'm
Such
sorry,
but you
can't do
line.
It.
Such a fine line.
Yeah. Because the president's role is such a straight role.
And cutting the pie thing. Like he's trimming down certain things that are too farcical or too slapsticky.
Uh-huh.
And it becomes uncomfortable. It's like, why am I laughing at this? And he never gives you the full, like, oh, this is to be dismissed. This is just a total. He's like, no. This is not. You can't dismiss this as a pure slapstick farce.
Right.
You just can't. And I'm not going to let you. So maybe in that sense, the pie thing had to go.
Yeah.
And the over silliness, you know, if he overdid the muffly, maybe that had to go.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the
fine line.
And the tone was his and his alone, like
Sellers?
No, Kubrick, I think, okay. Of like that line that he wanted to walk.
Yeah.
I think was his alone. Like right. he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And it was just genius.
And I guess there were lots of edits of the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, apparently they cut it a lot of times. I mean, you know, he was pretty obsessive at this point in his career he was pretty exacting.
And hands-on. Yeah. Like, I know there was an editor credited, but everything I read says that editor and also obviously Kubrick the room cutting tape. Did you ever do that? Were you ever cutting film?
Yeah. I started off cutting splicing? on a Steenbeck editing machine. And
same here. That was fun.
Yeah. Even before that, I was cutting 16 millimeter, which is, 8 millimeters like spaghetti.
Yeah.
But I had a little 8 millimeter cutting
splicing. Yeah, I did too, man.
But I cut my first couple of short films I made were 16 millimeter, and I had to get a work print and cut with a work print.
That's awesome. Sure. That's what when I did.
It was insane. The bins with all the stuff hanging.
Uh-huh.
It was
little white gloves.
Tough.
Grease pencils.
Yeah. And then you had to get your negative cutter to conform everything.
Yeah.
And that was expensive.
Such a cool process. I mean, it's better now. Yeah. I'm not one of these guys that's like, oh.
Avid came out pretty much for the year I graduated from film school. It was like Avid came out and then.
And everything that you had learned was forgotten.
Yeah, so I couldn't get a job editing because everybody coming out behind me knew how to do digital editing.
Yeah,
so.
But that was just the process. Like, you know, editing is an art.
Yeah.
And no matter if you're cutting film or doing it with a click of the mouse, you just got to learn the new system.
Right.
There
is something wonderful that's happened with when you have the nonlinear digital editing that is, it's like you can move so quickly that you can entertain several conversations with yourself. You can have a backlog of ideas that you can kind of quickly. It's just a different game. You can edit. It's just informs my.
Yeah.
It's just so different that I know that it's 30 years ago now, but like, it changed my brain. I'm like, oh, I can compose here. I can
write. Do you cut all your own stuff?
Pretty much to date, I've cut my own movies.
Like you don't work with an editor at all?
No. I mean, I would love to if I found one.
Uh-huh. Would you be able to, you think?
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's funny because I talked to David Bruckner. He's working on a movie called Nighthouse right now with Rebecca Hall. And he, you know, he always has these other editors that he's having to work with now because it's just contractually.
Right.
But it's still a director's cut. But he's an editor. Like, that's his gift.
Oh,
like,
really?
He's magic at editing. He's, he's badass. So I'm like, how do you sit there and watch them push the buttons? And I haven't had to deal with that really yet. There was one instance on a movie I made called The Vault, which was – we had another editor. But luckily, we got rid of that editor and I took over again and tried to salvage the movie. But
did your own thing.
Yeah, so it's like a cinematographer. If I could find a cinematographer, you know, and I've found some that I love, and I'm like, okay. And when I finally found that, I was like, okay, I feel good about not worrying about that.
Yeah.
But right now, the editing, I don't, yeah.
So much fun.
It's wonderful.
Editing's the best.
Yeah.
So a couple of things here at the end of the movie that I loved is a couple of lines. Is one, that last phone call with Dimitri and President Muffly, when he's explaining like the current situation here, like, you know, you're just going to have to find that plane and shoot it down, basically.
Right.
He goes, well, I'm sorry they're jamming your radar and flying so low. That's what they're trained to do. It's initiative.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I love it. And then when Strangelove is describing the post-war rebuilding effort, when he goes, animals could be bred and slaughtered. Oh, God. I mean, Sellers was such a genius. He left us so soon. He was 54 years old.
Was he?
Yeah.
Just 54?
54. And he fell over at a breakfast table. dead of a heart attack.
Yeah, I think I think he was also had a lot of like demons.
Oh yeah,
as the best comics often do, right?
Yeah, I'd like to read a good biography on him because he was he had a lot of problems.
You know who's an expert on Sellers?
Who?
Is Scott Poitras.
Oh really?
Yeah, he even was gonna he was trying to put together a film where he was gonna play Sellers.
Oh wow!
Yeah. He's and he can do a Sellers impersonation.
Oh, really?
Sellers doing other characters.
Well, like, I was about to say, no one even knows who Sellers was, and I think that was his whole jam, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he even admitted
that he didn't have any other personas outside. Yeah, of playing
he was
these
a tough
characters.
Dude. I mean, he was married 4 times, and
yeah.
admittedly, just a sort of a monster.
Right.
I did see the Jeffrey Rush thing that they did a few years ago.
I didn't see that.
What? That was a while ago. The Lives of Peter Sellers or whatever.
Oh, I didn't. Mm-mm.
It's good. I mean, it's worth a watch, but. You know, Britt Eklund, one of his wives, came out and she was like, I didn't like it because it portrayed him as a human.
Oh.
And they're like, he was a monster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah, he was a tough guy. Depression, you know, drug addiction, alcoholism. Right. I'm not sure how bad the drugs were. I know he was a big pothead, which is, you know, who cares about that? But
right.
He was a messed up guy.
Yeah, it fits into that whole I don't know, the whole theory about the American clown and how I'll get into that some other time. But
yeah.
Basically just the idea that, you know, we hate our clowns. In other cultures, clowns represent they're sort of outside of they're even more praised in some primal cultures than the priest or the medicine man.
We hate our clowns.
Yeah, they're praised because they are beyond dogma because they are like, okay, they'll come in and the trickster is understands something that is outside. Like you think you understand the mind of God?
Right.
Well, actually, that's laughable
because
there's no way you could. And so they have in some senses they're more sacred than the priest. Or whoever is the spokesman, but in the United States or it's in the Western culture, it seems like we're so terrified of the clown that he becomes monstrous, like in the movie It or
right.
you know these other movies like that. But we're terrified of them, and then the clowns that we have that are comedians, they tend to have all these demons, and they carry with them this the sad clown, the you know, and then the suicidal tendencies and the self-destruction,
right.
You know, and I think it's part of that whole equation.
Did you watch Baskets?
No.
Is Zach Galifianakis's show?
Uh-uh.
You should watch Baskets.
Okay.
It's great. He was a clown.
Oh, cool. Okay.
In the show.
Okay. That sounds perfect.
Yeah, it was really good.
But I think about like Joker, the movie Joker. And
yeah. Did you see it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just that these characters that we're just terrified of. Mm-hmm. Anyway. I don't know. It seems like that's part of the equation with Robin Williams and Peter Sellers and these other you know guys who are somewhat self-destructive. Or,
yeah.
You know. Yeah.
All right, man. You got anything else?
Do I?
Look through your notes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably going to walk out here and go, oh, yeah, I forgot to talk about that thing.
Oh, that's all right.
Did we talk about Pablo Ferro? The titles?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Pablo Ferro.
Uh-huh. I thought that was cool.
That's very cool. And it all comes together because I never noticed that was the same exact script, basically.
No, I think we covered some good stuff here. I just think the movie's important because I just think it stands alone. I don't think there's anything quite like it.
Yeah.
And so... When I saw it, it was one of those movies that when you see it, you're just giddy because you're just like, oh, my God, I can't believe somebody did this.
Yeah, and it's a movie you want to talk about with other people.
And it's the most efficient movie in the world. I mean, like every scene is so specifically clear cut. And
there's no fat in this movie
whatsoever. Yeah, but thank you for having me.
Of course, man. Think about what you want to do next. I'll have you on before March, but where can people find The Dark Red in March?
The Dark Red... It'll be on all of the pay outlets like iTunes and Google Play.
Yeah,
and,
we'll do a big
all that stuff
promo push for it.
So we'll and then beyond that, we'll yet to be seen if it'll be like a Netflix thing at some point or what.
Cool. Maybe
we're probably going to do a theatrical release, like limited. So
maybe around the release, it'd be fun to get you and whoever you want to invite, key players.
That'd be great.
From maybe your DP and the lead actress. And
sure.
That'd be fun. Sit around, do a little round table.
That'd be awesome.
Just about the making of it and some insider stuff. I know people love that stuff.
Would love that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, think about what you want to do next as well.
Okay. Cool.
And we'll get you in here like in the new year.
Okay.
Fantastic. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having me, man.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.